I was wanting to drop out for a long time. I hate school. I'm not getting any value out of this thing. They just wanted me to be obedient little soldiers sitting in the classroom. I just didn't want to be a part of that culture, a part of that obedient, creativity suppressing culture. For me, like AirChat just felt like I was able to connect with people at a much more deeper level than I would on these other platforms. What we kind of want to be is like what Twitter was to blogs, that's what we want to be to podcasts. To make any discovery, you kind of have to criticize and reject the current idea of how the world works, right? If you want to make any discovery, if you want to do anything that nobody's ever done before, you kind of have to do something that is against the current way of thinking or the current way of doing it. I was no longer constrained by my geographical location because of the internet, and I think what Bitcoin offers is like it's kind of an internet of money. I think fundamentally it's a tool of autonomy, and you get your freedom back, as you say.
Welcome back to the Theia Podcast, where we talk with the brightest minds in the worlds of technology, finance, economics, and startups. Today, I have the pleasure of sitting down with Arjun Kamani, a high school dropout and support/marketing lead at AirChat. Arjun, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
For sure. So I've been following your Twitter for a while, and I might say you are very prolific. You're very profound for a gentleman who is as young as you are. So you're a high school dropout building an app with Naval Ravikant. How did that happen?
The dropping out thing happened after I joined AirChat, which is Naval's company, Naval and Brian Norgaard. I was obviously posting a lot on Twitter, and I had my own blog and podcast, still have them. One of my friends invited me to this private beta of an app that Naval started. At that time, nobody really knew about it. It was still in private beta with like close, trusted family and friends of Naval's using the app. And so through this friend, I got an invite and I joined. And you know, it was pretty early, so Naval was like responding to everybody and he was checking out everybody's posts. And so I just hopped on there and like started talking to these really smart people. And then I think Naval took an interest in me, and he started a private DM chat on the same app. And I was just expressing how, how grateful I was, firstly, to be on the app, but also how cool the vision was for the app. And then I just, in that private DM, I just pitched him an idea to work for AirChat. And then he agreed. So that's kind of the short story of how that happened. And later, just like a month after that, I think I dropped out of high school.
Wow. Extremely cool. And so for you, what does dropping out of high school mean? Obviously, a whole host of people who've gone on to, be extremely successful in the technology space and the startup space are either high school or college dropouts. For you, what drove you to make that decision? Obviously, it's a pretty monumental decision to not even want to go and complete your GED. So clearly, there had to be some huge opportunity costs for you on the other side of it, that you decided to forfeit instead of completing your GED. So kind of what was that whole decision-making process like? Where was your head at when you were deciding to drop out of high school? And then kind of what was your family thinking as well?
Yeah, sure. So I was wanting to drop out for a long time, right? It wasn't just that I joined AirChat and now like I'm making some money and now I'm going to drop out of school. It was like, I hate school. I'm not getting any value out of this thing. They just wanted me to be obedient little soldiers sitting in the classroom, just repeating kind of the bullshit the teachers are telling me. And I just didn't want to be a part of that culture, a part of that, obedient, creativity suppressing culture that I was pushed into. And, I was expressing my dissent in various ways. So just one funny example was like when I was in school, we had this psychology assignment, and I just completely disagreed with the nature of the research that was required for that psychology assignment. So I wrote like a 7-page memo on why I'm not doing this assignment. And that's literally what I titled it. And then I submitted it. And then obviously my psychology teacher read it, and then she took me to the principal's office, and like the principal actually commended me for my critical thinking skills, but then she said, you just have to do the regular project as well. So, they, I don't know, with one thing they're like, okay, they want to encourage this, or they think they should encourage it because it's, critical thinking and creativity. These are the buzzwords in education now. But anyone who's gone to school and like been through that process knows how it's completely the opposite of that. So I just don't want to be a part of it, and I wasn't getting any value out of it. So the reason, as I said, I was wanting to drop out for a long time, but the tough part was convincing my parents, right? So that took like months and months of me telling them like the school thing really isn't for me, and I found this other stuff online that I'm doing, and let me just go all in into building my personal brand or building connections. Before that, I was already like working for a marketing agency doing some copywriting stuff. So I was like, I just want to go all in on this and like writing my blog and my podcast. But it was very hard convincing my parents, obviously. But I think like when I joined AirChat and then they saw like I was working with some big figures and getting a good paycheck, that's when they kind of gave in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it certainly helps to see you doing the actual work and have something tangible, and knowing that you're not just dropping out of high school to go, play hooky, dropping out of high school for the sake of it, but because you actually have something really worthwhile on the other side that you have to chase. That's awesome, man. I commend you for that. It certainly takes a lot to be able to, go that path. Obviously, some people will, decide that they don't want to go to college, but dropping out of high school for something, it takes a lot of courage and a lot of guts, and so I commend you for that. So, I have AirChat. I have not said anything on the app personally. I have scrolled, I have listened, so I've kind of been a butterfly on the wall for quite some time. I've had it for 6, 7 months. It's really cool. And so, I want you to explain to the listeners what is AirChat. The app slogan is "Just Talk." It's an audio-first social network. How is it different from existing social platforms, and how is it disruptive in the space?
Yeah, so let me take it one by one. What is AirChat? We've gone through many iterations, and I don't know if you know, but the idea for AirChat came about like 5 years ago now. I only joined the team 1.5 years ago, when that was when like things really started to pick up pace, and we, constantly iterating and building the product. But the current version of the of the app, sorry. The current version of the app on the App Store is the one that's been like kind of the most popular, or like has had its virality, but then that did kind of slow down. So we are working on yet another iteration of that app, and that is currently in the works. And I'm happy to tell you more about it, but that app will be released shortly, maybe a couple of weeks from now. So it would be kind of a different app, but in the sense the functionality is the same. It is a voice first app, but it's not really a social network. In the sense, we're just trying to make it easy for you to create podcasts with your friends. So it's like a micro podcasting tool. And what we kind of want to be is like what Twitter was to blogs. That's what we want to be to podcasts. So Twitter basically made everybody a micro blogger, right? You could just spin up, people would write these 10,000 word blogs, and then people would, read them. And what Twitter did was like it literally made these micro blogs and made everybody kind of a blogger, and people would have discussions in the comment section, and that's how things would be. So with AirChat, we want to make it really simple for you to just, pick up your phone and start like just chat with friends, and be able to export that parts of the conversation that you find interesting onto X and onto other platforms that you like, onto your podcast platforms. And so in a sense, make everybody a creator, or like, creator in the sense like you're just having conversations with your friends. And if you want to export it, and if you want to have a wider audience look at it, then you can publish it outside of the app.
Gotcha. That's extremely interesting. So you're pivoting from kind of this style of posting to your friends almost on AirChat, and then now you're pivoting to making it so it's kind of short form podcasting. I like that analogy. AirChat is going to do for podcasts what Twitter did for blogs. I like that a lot. Where did that idea come about? Obviously, as a startup, you're trying to find product market fit. You're trying to find your kind of your minimum viable product. Along the way, where did you realize that that's where the value in AirChat truly was in creating these short form podcasts?
Yeah, so I feel like we traversed a lot of areas in social audio. And if you also like notice other apps like Clubhouse and X Spaces, they have their own niche, but nobody really uses Clubhouse anymore. And we also like experiment with quite a few different kinds of social audio apps. And now we're pivoting to a model that's like not social inherently. It may turn out to be social after a while. It might evolve into a social network later. But we're starting out as a tool, basically as a utility tool, just for you to create podcasts. And I think that's where like kind of the world is heading, right? People are, I don't know if it's true. Like people have been saying that people have low attention spans, or like they're, they're distracted more than ever. But I recently saw this post where, it was just a picture of everybody reading books on a train, just engrossed in their books entirely, kind of like today people are on their phones. And the caption was, "Not a single person living in the moment. Everybody just reading the goddamn books." And so there's a lot of pessimism to this idea that, oh, humans are just like driven by these algorithms. And I think to some extent that's true, but whenever you're doing that, you're always choosing to participate in that algorithm, right? There's many people who don't have access to phones, or they choose not to use their phones altogether. So, but we think, these podcasts, like podcast snippets, are just a great way to get some instant value, right? And we go on these podcasts, and I tend to ramble a bit, but there's a lot of people who tend to ramble. And with their chat, it's like you just record an audio message, and you can record it anytime you want, right? And you can delete it if it's not that great, and you can re-record it. And so I feel like that quality is inherently much higher, because it's asynchronous, right? It's not live on the spot where you have to block a time on your calendar, and then you have to if you mess up something, you can't really edit it very easily. So we just wanted to make podcasting effortless.
Make podcasting effortless. And I love that notion, because you're taking the best parts of podcasting from a creation standpoint and a consumption standpoint, and then you're making it so you could just do that. You're cutting out all the fat. Most people don't like listening to all of the pleasantries at the start of a podcast and listening about three quarters of the way in to where the meat and potatoes is and that really good soundbite is. And if you are, so that's from the listener side of things. And then if you're the creator side of things, chances are you think of these things while you're just walking around, right? You're having a walk, you're out and about, you're reading your book, and you want to say something, but maybe Twitter isn't the best medium to do it, right? Writing won't get your point across. You need to speak it. And so you don't have any kind of podcast yet. You could fire up the camera and then film something and then post it, but that'd be strange. And so having a medium where you could film that podcast soundbite, put it out to people who love listening to that kind of short form content, I think that is an absolutely excellent idea.
Yeah, appreciate that. That's kind of exactly the thinking towards it.
Absolutely, yeah. Cutting out the fat, making it the best part of podcasting. Very cool. So, one thing I am wondering, because I know people certainly portray themselves differently across, say, Instagram and Twitter, or Twitter and Facebook, right? You want to look a certain way for your family and friends who may be following you on Facebook, and then another way for Instagram, where maybe you're trying to attract people to your profile or build a personal brand, and then maybe a different way on Twitter where you're trying to do something else entirely and be a little bit more intellectual. Have you noticed differences, kind of, having used AirChat for so long, having been on the ground, seeing people, kind of learn how to use this thing? Have you noticed any differences in the way that people portray themselves over AirChat, right, this audio first medium, compared to a text or image based one like Twitter or Instagram?
Oh yes, definitely. I feel like it's just so much more authentic and intimate when it is voice based. Instagram just feels like signaling to me. You're posting a picture, and you're trying to convey some information. Maybe it's different. You have different motives. People might just want to be posting updates for their family or for their friends, or sometimes I don't know, attract the opposite sex. For me, like AirChat just felt like I was able to connect with people at a such at a much more deeper level than I would on these other platforms. Don't get me wrong, like I've made great friends through Twitter and through X. Like the fact that we're having this conversation, we met on X, and I met so many of my X friends in real life, and it's been amazing. But with AirChat, it just gets you this immediate connection with the other person, which I really haven't seen on any other platform. And the ability to jump in and talk to that person and reply to that person, I think is kind of magical. Like you're on this other platform and somebody has posted an image, but all you can do is comment on that image. It really isn't that authentic. You know, you can slide into the DMs, but again, it's text-based. But when you leave a voice note, I think it's much more intimate. So I definitely see a lot of differences. And you know, when you're just texting, it's way easier to say things that you would text, but you wouldn't otherwise say, right? So people are often like very aggressive in text, especially in political discussions, but they normally wouldn't say that to a person, or even if like it's asynchronous, like they wouldn't say that in a post. So I've definitely seen like really, really stark differences.
Absolutely. And I think if we're talking about the most human form of social media that humanity could probably coalesce around, we'd want to be minimizing the gap between what people actually are and the way that they portray themselves, you know, in the way that they communicate. And I think through doing voice notes, that authenticity naturally comes to the fore because it's a lot easier to be fake when it's just an image and a caption that comes with it. It's a little bit more difficult to be fake when it's text-based or you're doing videos that are edited, and it's extremely difficult to be fake when you're doing audio-based because it's so intimate. It's in the moment. You kind of have to portray yourself the way that you are, and I think that makes for a much more fruitful discussion, but also for a social platform that is probably closest to an approximation of how we communicate in real life, which I think is probably the best that social media can possibly get. Just a one-to-one reflection of the way people communicate, and the only difference is that you can now do it at any distance instead of there also being other variables about people, like, you know, not being authentic.
Yeah, totally agree. It does feel like, you know, almost real life. And when it's like almost immediate conversations, I just posted a message and then I get the reply back. And especially when it's like, you know, they mention my name. I don't know. Like, there's just something about like somebody speaking my name, right, in their own accents, in their own ways. Like that's just kind of beautiful to hear that. And whenever I get that notification with my name, I'm like, somebody mentioned me. I'm like, okay, I click on it, and it's kind of beautiful.
Absolutely. It's extremely cool. Well, I'm excited to continue tracking and watching the development of it. I know I'll certainly be downloading the new and updated app when it comes out. I want to shift into something you tweeted 2 days ago that I really like and I really appreciate. You tweeted, "People who say it cannot be done should not interrupt those who are doing it." And it was in reference to an article saying that man will never colonize Mars. Elon Musk is never going to colonize Mars. I want to ask you, because this is obviously been a this has been a trope since the dawn of time. Kind of people sitting up in the bleachers who are criticizing and throwing tomatoes at the man in the arena, right? The guy who's actually doing things and building things and creating. What would you say is the key difference between the man in the arena, right? Someone who's building things like Elon Musk and someone who's filling the bleachers, right? The tens of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people who are filling the bleachers and the handful of people who are actually building things. What do you think the key differences between those two types of people are?
Yeah, I mean, talk is cheap, right? You can say whatever you want, but ultimately, if you're not doing something, then you know, you're just like wasting time. But I don't think there's any fundamental difference that, you know, people sitting in the bleachers are like they don't have a fundamental difference where it isn't that they can't be like, you know, the people in the arena. I think it's just like some ideas that they have that, you know, that might kind of tend them to be in a certain way, or like to be on the sidelines. They might think like, oh, if you're just like wanting to control these things, or to you know, transform the Earth and to transform the Mars, that's inherently a bad thing. So I mean, if you think something is bad, then obviously you're not, you know, you're probably not going to want to do it. And so that, then you criticize it, even if like you can definitely be wrong. So I guess, yeah, I don't think there's any fundamental difference. They can all be players in the arena, but just some of them have the right ideas, and they have the right kind of mindset, and then they go ahead and do them, I guess.
Absolutely, yeah. For me, I think it's just a it's a difference in the willingness to do. The people who are filling the bleachers know exactly what they need to do, but they're just not doing it. And then the people in the arena who are building, they know what they need to do and they do it. You know, it's just a matter of willingness and also the ability to be your own impetus, be the thing that starts it instead of waiting around for an impetus. One analogy that I've always used is, you know, after high school and after college, if you're going to find, you know, a girlfriend or a wife, there's no kind of event that you can wait for to be the impetus. There's no prom you can wait for to go and ask somebody. Oh, prom is coming up, so then I'll ask her.
Right.
No, you have to be the impetus. And so I think one of the key differences, if not the biggest and only difference, apart from mentality differences, is that the people in the arena who are building things, who are doing things, are willing to do exactly what they know they need to do. And then the people who are filling the bleachers know what they need to do, but put it off in perpetuity.
Yeah, or maybe they just expect somebody else to tell them what to do, right? Like in school, you're always told what to do. Oh, right now you have to be sitting in class. When you're done with school, you have to be doing your homework. Or now you have this other class. So kind of your life is planned out for you by somebody else. But now, like when you're an adult and like people expect you to be, you know, kind of taking agency for your life and doing stuff on your own, you're like, okay, well, what do I do? Like, maybe I'll just do this college thing because everybody's doing it, and then go into a job because, you know, that's what people do and that's what people have been doing. So, yeah, I guess it takes agency to, you know, to figure out what you want to do and go ahead and do it. And, you know, not be swayed away by what other people think is interesting, but following your own genuine interests.
Absolutely. So one of the topics that you talk about quite frequently, you repost a lot of stuff from Javier Millay. You know, clearly you are of the Austrian school of economics, and so, you know, I applaud you for that. The only real school of economics, the other one is the school of communism.
It's not Austrian economics, it's just economics.
That's exactly right. It's just economics, and then they're the other guys, we call them. So we have one presidential candidate here in the United States, Kamala Harris, whose platform largely revolves around price controls. I'm sure you've seen a few of the things that she's said. She's not only talking about price controls for grocery stores, but also price controls for landlords. This is invariably, everywhere this has been tried, it leads to capital flight. All of the businesses leave the country. Nobody wants to operate businesses there anymore. And then all of a sudden, because of the political environment, the economy that you had that people could go and participate in is now basically zero. There's no economic growth, if any economic activity. Why do you think the Austrian school of economics, or as you call it, just economics, why do you think that's more in line with reality than the other guys, than this Keynesian school of thought that seems to drive a lot of mainstream economics and also, you know, kind of U.S. higher education?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I'm not really sure if the history of these ideas. I haven't looked that much into the history. But I think the more interesting question is that why, even, you know, centuries after these Keynesian ideas and other schools of economics as ideas have been brutally refuted by the Austrians, why is it that economic illiteracy is still so prevalent in the world, right? And I guess one, like, easy way to answer it would be the truth is hard to come by. Right, that the Austrian School of Economics came out with the theory, and like people haven't discovered it for themselves, haven't recreated the knowledge for themselves. But I think like one other reason could be that, you know, we have these educational institutions, and like they're highly influenced by the government and their kind of influence. So. Why is it like these ideas aren't in those institutions, or like why aren't they spreading across to so many people? And like so many people who call themselves economists, like why don't they know these ideas, right? Why don't they know better? And I guess like it just could be the way like education is influenced by the government today, and obviously, the whole idea of Austrian economics is like maximum freedom for the individual, and the state inherently doesn't like that idea, and they will try to propagate what fits for them, and like they will try to propagate their survival. So yeah, I guess that could be like a deeper reason why. But as for why only the Austrians know it, like again, I'm not sure. And why they came up with it, I'm sure that's an interesting question, and people should look it up. But I'm not aware of that history.
Yeah, absolutely. And you bring up a good point. Economic illiteracy kind of is. Really, it's always been prevalent. It's always been, you know, a huge issue. But I think now more than ever, it is being actively propagated so much. Over the last 15 years-ish, If we're talking like right around the 2008 financial crisis, a lot of people looked at what happened then and then decided to turn to things like communism and socialism and begin pushing and propagating these things. And I think largely the reason for economic illiteracy is because it makes the will of the people yield more so unto government than to, you know, them wanting to hold on to it themselves. If the economic school of thought is that all problems can be fixed by the government, then you drive the individuals to vote to grant that government more power, right? And so it just makes their job easier, you know, if every single institution of higher education, rather than propagating economic realities, right, it makes it much easier if you can convince everybody that the government is a necessity in order to make the world go around, and they should be the central planner. They should be arbitrarily setting the cost of capital rather than, gee, I don't know, the capital allocators themselves, you know, and they should dictate all of that. They should dictate prices rather than the free market. And for me, where my head has always been at with this, why economic literacy is so prevalent is because it makes, frankly, it makes it easier for to turn people into good little cattle. And in the same way that you said, the difference between the you know, the men in the arena and the people in the bleachers is the people in the bleachers, right? They've gone their entire lives just doing what everyone else is doing, just following the next step. All they know is being told what to do. And so it kind of, it all fits. It all fits. By pushing the Keynesian school of economic thought, you're driving people to want the government to kind of steer the direction of everything, of markets, of the economy, of their own lives. You know, and it fits perfectly for a populace who's been used to that since birth. I don't know what your general thoughts on that are, if you have any other ideas about why economic literacy is so prevalent.
Yeah, I think that's right. I made another tweet where I said it was, you know, it was for people who hate capitalism. I said, people who hate capitalism, do you hate the part where you can't control others or the part where now you have to figure out what you want to do with your life, right? Because there's like two options. Oh, like with capitalism, okay, there's free markets and respect of private property, you can't control and dictate what others should do. But now you have to, you know, take agency of your own life, and to nobody's going to make choices for you, and nobody's going to give you free money. And there's no such thing as free money. Everybody, somebody's paying for it in the end of the day. At the end of the day, so yeah, I think I totally agree with that. As for, you know, maybe what you could do with Kamala Harris, she's also explicitly pointed out that she wants equality of outcome. Like, I don't know if you've seen those videos of where she's like, oh, what we want is like, we have to recognize that people don't have equal opportunities from birth. So what we want to do is that we want to, we will make sure that everybody ends up at the same place together. And equality of outcome is one of the most dangerous ideas that humans have ever invented. And she's like an explicit proponent of it, which is preposterous. And that's definitely not going to lead to a good place, I'm sure.
No, certainly not at all. And she kind of, I mean, Kamala Harris is a queen of contradicting herself. She said people start with different economic backgrounds from birth. Okay, so then the logical explanation should be we should try to find a way to bring them all to the starting line, right? And then the outcomes will be what the outcomes will be, but at the very least we can equalize the starting line, which is what basically everyone universally agrees on to some extent. But then she goes on to contradict herself and say, therefore, everyone should have the same outcome. No, that doesn't make any sense based on the first clause of your sentence, right? But she's wildly economically illiterate. I think she is the very first byproduct of all of this extreme propaganda that we've introduced into the schooling system over the last many decades. And also the fact that she is basically neck and neck with Donald Trump. I understand people don't like the guy for various reasons, but the fact that this woman is basically 50-50 split with Donald Trump to win the presidency, and not a coherent sentence has been strung together by her. It is truly baffling, and it does speak to this whole idea of people being, you know, people wanting to be told what to do, wanting to be told what to think. The fact that this person has any support behind her whatsoever,
right? And they keep moving the goalposts, right? I posted this other post yesterday that it was actually a quote from Ayn Rand, and she said, socialists said that, okay, in our with our system, everybody will have affordable shoes, and we will make shoes so cheap and so nice that everybody will be able to afford them. And obviously that system failed, and people, you know, people, they failed to produce shoes. And then they changed the goalposts and said, oh no, socialism is still superior because it's better to walk barefoot, right? So you don't need shoes at all. So yeah, they keep changing the goalposts, and they, I guess, how do you hit the target? And like, you just change the goalposts, and then whatever spot you've hit, you just paint the post around that target. So it's weird.
Absolutely. So, you know, higher education has inarguably failed our students. If there are so many, if there are hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people who are coming out of these universities every single year who believe these ideas wholeheartedly, there's no argument against the fact that university has failed our students. Public education has failed our students. I believe a huge part of this has to do with the central planning component of what we do here in the United States, guaranteeing student loans. That is grossly misallocated human capital. Students who don't need specialized education are pushed into college. And in doing so, you know, apart from doctors, lawyers, engineers, there really isn't anybody who needs to go to school in order to figure out what to do. If you want to start a business, you don't need to become a business major. You can start a business, right? It doesn't take a lot of specialized education. And if it does, every book is free if you know where to look on the internet, and information is free and abundant. And so in doing so, universities today, to me, act less like places of education and more places of programming for the regime, for the people who seek to control us. What are your thoughts on college being less of a place of education, a place where the best and brightest come, to a place of programming? Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, entirely. I think, you know, as you said, everything's online, all the knowledge of the internet. Like, this is even better than the Library of Alexandria, right, which is portrayed as such a magnificent place and time to be alive in. But the reality is there's never been a better time to be alive than right now. And, you know, if you want to learn anything, you can just go online. And even, like, you know, top colleges like Yale, Yale and Harvard, MIT, they all have free online courses. So you can literally get all the knowledge that you want online for free. And so I guess, like, what people really go to college for is that credential, right? But more and more we're seeing that, like, you don't really need credentials in this new world. And things like your X account can literally be your resume, right? So there's differences of different kind of employers, but I don't know the exact statistics on this, but not a lot of people care about the traditional sense of, like, okay, you graduated from a great college. People would, I think now, like, at least in the Silicon Valley startup space, but it's also growing in more places in the world, they would much more appreciate, like, a dropout from Harvard or Stanford than, like, somebody's actually gone through the entire education, as you say, programmed by the regime. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know, like, Naval has this great question, and he says, like, if you didn't get the credential, would you still go to college? If you didn't get the degree, would you still go to college? And I guess most people would say no. you can literally get all the other stuff online for free. So I don't know if they'd be motivated to study when there's nobody telling them to learn these things. But or if there isn't a threat of, like, failing their grade. But perhaps they will be, and perhaps, you know, they'll just follow their own interests rather than, like, somebody else telling them what they should study. And I think that's much more fruitful than anyone, like, you doing something that you don't want to, but somebody else is telling you to do.
Absolutely. Information is free and abundant. If not for the credential that came at the end of the tunnel with college, the majority of people would not be going. And you're exactly right. My Twitter account, every single job I've had after college has come from my X account, has come from, basically, it's my living, breathing resume. That's the exact same analogy that I've used when talking about Twitter, right? People have DM'd me, people have reached out to me, how did you get a position here? How did you get into this position? And every single time, invariably, I say, just talk about what you can do, talk about what can add value and bring value to the table for free through your Twitter account and through other mediums and creating a personal brand. And then you'll land where you need to, right? I think that is the way forward. That is the way of the world, is colleges and universities become increasingly less useful as an actual sorting mechanism for who knows their stuff and who doesn't. I think the greatest barometer well, the sole barometer in the world that we're moving into for whether or not somebody is capable is what they have done, right? Not what they have learned or the school that they went to, but what they are done. That is the most accurate measure of capability. As we move into a world where college becomes less useful and information becomes free and abundant. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, exactly. If you're a coder, right, your GitHub profile. If you're a writer, maybe your X profile or your blog, Substack, whatever. So there's like so many outlets that people can just like do a Google search for, and they can literally know whatever there is to know about you in terms of like a public image and stuff. So that's, I think, that's kind of my idea of the future of resumes, going to these profiles and like what you've actually achieved and proof of that achievement rather than like just these stamps of authority.
Absolutely. So we talked about high school briefly. I've seen you tweet a few times about your stance on schooling, and you seem to wish there was way less of it, if any at all. You've talked a little bit about why that is, right? The aspect of them being controlling and not necessarily being a breeding ground for creativity, which I agree with. But what's your stance on schooling? Do you think we should have less of it, no schooling at all? And in its place, what should take its place, if anything?
Yeah, fundamentally, I think, you know, what we want is voluntarism. So children should have a choice of whether they want to go to school or not. And I guess just naturally, if children decide they don't want to go to school, and I think like the vast majority of people, children would not want to go to school. Like if you ever, you know, if there's a rainy day outside and it's like really heavily raining here, so that's often the case in Mumbai. When that happens, and you know, my sister has to skip school because school is shut that day. Like you should see the joy on her face, right? She did not want to go to school, and she's so happy that okay, I don't have to go to school one day. So I think that's the case with a lot of kids. They, you know, so they're just like kind of told to go there, and they don't feel like there is this other option. But I guess they were given another option, and they were given an option to do something outside of school, I think they would invariably pick that option. So that's like kind of my fundamental philosophy, that it should flow with the kids' idea, and not like some authority's idea or the parents' idea that, okay, you need to go to school and you need to study these subjects. So that's like kind of my case for school or against school.
Gotcha. Fantastic. And so in that sense, because I think a lot of what people are immediately wondering when they hear about that idea is, how would they learn? Where would they learn? We've grown very used to this idea of learning can only take place in the classroom, particularly people who that's all they know. And so I guess this is your chance to tell people who may be asking that question to you. You know, without school, where would kids learn?
Yeah, I feel like the same people who kind of say that would also believe, if the government mandated walking lessons for children after 6 months, that if you don't send your kid to that walking lesson, then they'll never learn how to walk. Learning is like the most, like that's kind of like what we've been put on this planet to do. Like we naturally create knowledge, like as naturally as a baby sucks mother's milk. So I think children want to learn, and they have that desire to learn, and they know how to learn. You don't have to teach somebody how to learn, right? People pick up children pick up languages without somebody forcing them to learn these languages. And so I think just having an environment where they're able to maximally be absorbed in their own interests. And, you know, just, you know, buy them books or like buy them iPads and let them watch videos about things they're interested in, like connect with people, connect with other kids and, you know, even adults. Like I think one mistake that, or not a mistake, it's just the way the school is designed, but you're just put in a classroom where everybody is the same age, and then some people might not be on the same levels, right? Like, and in a sense, like not like above somebody, but they just might not have the same interests. And I think like kids can have a lot to learn from adults, and adults can have a lot to learn from kids, right? Like whenever I speak to some kids, like I'm always amazed at their curiosity and like how before school is, you know, before like they've grown up a bit and like school has early snatched that curiosity and creativity from them, they ask like such wonderful questions that have like just taking the answers to which I've just taken for granted, right? And it just makes me rethink, like, okay, that's an interesting question. I don't know, I should ask ChatGPT. so there's, yeah, I think what you want to do is like create an environment where kids can flourish and like flourish where like their creativity and curiosity can flourish. And you know, if they want to go to school, like let them try it out if you have the means. And but if they don't, like just respect their decision and yeah, treat them like people rather than like these other kinds of subhumans.
So my second to last question for you, you work with Naval, my favorite Naval adage of all time. This is a tweet of his from 2020, I think just after COVID locked down the entire United States, or just after we locked down the entire United States in response to COVID. But my favorite Naval adage of all time is, it's only the misfits who have a chance. So much so that I've gone and created a brand around this.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that.
This idea. Yeah. And so I'd like to see your interpretation of this quote, of what this quote means, and if you can apply it to yourself.
Yeah. Well, yeah, to make any discovery, you kind of have to criticize and reject the current idea of how the world works, right? If you want to make any discovery, if you want to do anything that nobody's ever done before, you kind of have to do something that is against the current way of thinking or the current way of doing it. So in that sense, like, I totally agree. Like, you know, to make new discoveries, you have to come up with your own ideas and be different from the norm. But it is interesting. Like, I saw this Peter Thiel into speech where he said, it is weird that how a lot of great startups in Silicon Valley are run by people who are slightly on the autistic spectrum. And he says, like, we should always turn this fact around and view it as an indictment of our whole society, that somebody who doesn't have good social skills and won't have the kind of the capacity for his ideas to be extinguished by these people, like, what does that say about a society, that we can't let these kind of weird people come up with crazy ideas and change the world, right? And that they have to be in their own socially isolated cell and kind of ponder things over it by themselves. But I think that's there's a lot of virtue in just being alone by yourself and thinking through things, and not needing somebody else's opinion on everything, and just choosing what you want to work on, you know, go ahead and work on that. I don't think I ever fit in school or like with any kind of group. The best conversations that I had were always one-on-one or with just a very small group of people, like one or two people max. I realized, like, when there's a group around, and like especially in school, like there's just a lot of similar kind of thinking, and people are not themselves when they're speaking in the groups. But when I was speaking to them, like, one by one, they were, like, completely different than they were in how we interacted with as groups. So that was, like, an interesting observation in school. I was always, like, trying to get, you know, connected with people, but I just found that nobody really shared my ideas in school. So I did try to convince people that, you know, this shit sucks. Like, you should consider dropping out, like, follow your interests. You know, you have this other great interest in painting and art, you should go ahead and pursue that. Like, why are you studying all this? I don't really have great connections, but thankfully with the internet, like, I could reach, you know, I was not no longer constrained by my geographical boundary, and so I could reach, like, people who were who could think more like me. I made friends through the internet, and then I met those friends in real life, which is incredible. So it is, you kind of have to find your people in a sense. And the easiest way to do that is to utterly be yourself. That's how you find the right people for you. Because if you're always putting on a socially acceptable mask, you're signaling the wrong thing to people, and you're attracting the wrong kind of people into your life. Because you're not being yourself. And so, people will think, oh, this guy is a certain way, and kind of the wrong people for you will think, oh, okay, this guy shares my interest, or I think he shares my interest, so then you'll go with them. But when you're just being yourself, you are discouraging all those people who are wrong from interacting with you, but you are also, like, signaling this beacon to attract people, you know, who you're likely to be friends with.
Absolutely. By leaning into who you actually are rather than trying to fit into a box, in the short term, it's uncomfortable, But in the long term, I like the way that you said it. You're sending out this beacon, right, to attract your own tribe. And I think that's where a lot of the utility of social platforms like X and like AirChat come in. The final question I have for you, talking about Bitcoin, obviously, Theia is a Bitcoin company. I have a block clock behind me. I have the Bitcoin white paper, which is ironically not on a white paper. It's on a black paper behind me on my other shoulder.
And dark mode is away.
Exactly. That's exactly right. That's why I chose that color. So talk about Bitcoin as a tool for human freedom. Obviously, a lot of this podcast has revolved around the notion of tyranny of free market capitalism. We've touched on that pretty heavily. And so talk about Bitcoin as a tool for human freedom. You know, it's given unconfiscatable property rights to 8 billion people, liberating people, you know, from the money printer. What's your pitch to the people about, you know, how Bitcoin is a tool of human freedom and why a zero allocation to Bitcoin is probably a very dangerous position to be in over the next several years?
Yeah, it's always hard to, you know, boil it down to just one thing, because people will come to Bitcoin or to these cryptocurrencies with different different ideas about them, different preconceptions. And I think one thing that's really useful is that not looking at the price level and the price volatility, especially if you're coming into Bitcoin, but really focusing on the technology and how important that is. And as you say, it's like, it's a way for, you know, humans to get their freedom back. And on the gold standard, we were sort of, it wasn't perfect in many ways, but now like Bitcoin is everything that gold was, but so much better with the current technology. So I think, again, it's hard to pinpoint on just what's one thing that would convince you about Bitcoin, but I forget who wrote that book, but I was reading it recently, and I'm blanking on the name right now, but it was a book called The Internet of Money, and he talks about like how Bitcoin is the Internet of Money, and what the Internet allowed you was like you could just log onto the Internet and you could post something like without censorship and anybody could see it, and kind of the freedom that it unlocked. And like we've been talking about how it sort of broadened my horizon and could I was no longer constrained by my geographical location because of the internet. And I think what Bitcoin offers is like it's kind of an internet of money where you're in control, and like nobody else is controlling you know how you're spending your money and like how your money is being inflated away. Obviously there's going to be price action, like price differences. I think fundamentally it's a tool of autonomy, and you get your freedom back, as you say.
Fantastic. I love the way that you position that in the same way that the internet eliminates that geographical difference. Bitcoin being a global form of money that anyone anywhere can use, also eliminates that kind of geographical or it closes that geographical arbitrage of somebody having an advantage by living in the United States versus say living you know where you are out in Mumbai or someone you know in the on the Horn of Africa or something like that. Fantastic answer, Arjun. Thank you so much for coming on. This has been a wonderful conversation. I'm so happy that you were able to talk to a whole host of people. So many clippable moments throughout this entire episode. You were spitting fire, my friend. So last thing before we wrap up here, where do you want to send people? Where can people find you?
Yeah, I'm pretty active on my X account. It's just my full name. And I have a Substack and a podcast, which can be found on arjunkimani.com.
Fantastic. So we'll be linking both of those in the show notes. And if you're watching this on X, then you could just click Arjun's profile in the tweet. I'd highly recommend you give him a follow. He is a young, up-and-coming guy, and he's going to do incredible things, not just with AirChat, but with for humanity. I have no doubt in that. Arjun, once again, thanks so much for the conversation.
Appreciate it, Joe. Thanks for having me. We'll be right back.